high and a hoot.
Good morning, good morning, you all. This is Brother Aaron Ammons, a.k.a. Brother A-Dub. You are listening to Higher Ground 90.1 FM on your listening dial. The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speaker. They do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated. So y'all know what that means. What I say down here, charge it to my heart, charge it to me, not to the folks down at WEFT. So, you all, it's going to be a pretty robust morning. We have some pretty interesting stuff to share with you when we get started. One of my guests will be Mr. George Wissmiller of the environmental organization Watch, yes. One of the members of Watch. And we'll be on here in just a few minutes talking about the Muhammad Aquifer and the consent decree that is being shopped around basically now from all the different government entities to hopefully sign off on it. That's what they're trying to get done. Well, Watch is not trying to get that done. And we're going to get into all of that here in a few minutes. Also, at the top of the hour, around 9 o'clock, I will be entering into a, I don't know if it's going to be an actual conversation. I'm hoping one of my good friends from down south will call in, but we'll be talking about the life of Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, who transitioned here just a couple of days ago, and her heroic efforts over the years in the civil rights movement, which have led to some amazing things in our country. So that's what's going to be happening this Saturday morning. And of course, you are always welcome to call in down here at 217-359-5483, 217-359-5483, or you can try 217-359-6545. That's 359-6545 if you want to fly live and have your thoughts and opinions expressed on the air or ask a question to myself or a guest that I have on. So you can also catch us at weft.org. We are streaming live. So if you have some folks who have knowledge about aquifers and landfills and stuff like that, why don't you call them up this morning and see if they want to chime in and be a part of this conversation. They can tune in again at weft.org and click on listen live and be a part of this conversation. So, of course, the farmer's market is going on, so we want to always encourage people to get out to the farmer's market, get you some good fresh produce. Of course, that after you get done listening to the show, right? Or while you're on your way over there to the farmer's market, you're tuning in to Higher Ground. I do appreciate it. So that's one thing that's going on, of course. The Urbana Middle School, the baseball, the Tigers, they have a baseball game today. If they don't get rained out anyway, they will be playing the state champion Normal Ironmen this morning. So hopefully Amir be able to play and they'll be out there on the field representing the city of Urbana. So go and cheer them on if you have some time on your hands. You want to get over there around 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock this morning. Also, I wanted to make an announcement about the there's an event coming up that we're doing with the in Breakfast Club, myself, and the other members of the North End Breakfast Club, along with the National Council of African American Men. We are a Speak Truth to the People conversation. We're going to do this on a regular basis. And what we want to do is have conversations in the park at the pavilion at Douglas, underneath the pavilion there. And we have topics of conversation that we'll have people present on, and we'll have we'll just have a conversation. It's going to be a 1 hour piece that we do called Speak the Truth to the People, Chopping It Up in the Park. So the next one is the first one actually is going to be Thursday, September the 3rd from 6:30 to 7:30. And we want to make sure that you are there at Douglas Park underneath the pavilion. And if that doesn't work, we're going to try to move it inside into the annex or into the library meeting room or something like that. But we're going to do this on a regular basis and have an opportunity to have information be shared with the community about the state that we're in, about the condition that we're in, and particularly as it relates to African-American people. So we want to make sure that you get this information. Speak Truth to the People is a joint initiative by the North End Breakfast Club and the National Council of African-American Men to sponsor weekly Thursdays from 6:30 to 7:30 conversations in Douglas Park. Speak Truth to the People consists of a 15-minute talk, cultural presentations like poetry, raps, and songs, and a group response. Each weekly talk will discuss a burning question facing black people locally, nationally, or globally. The talks are designed to provoke a critical conversation about the Black experience, conditions, representations, and perspectives locally, nationally, or globally. The cultural presentations are designed as edutainment and will use African-American cultures of resistance to stimulate hope for a better life. The conversations are designed to educate, to raise consciousness, and to grow the community of local activists fighting for racial justice. Speak Truth to the People, Thursday, September 3rd, 6:30 to 7:30 at Douglas Park. So I'm sure there's lots of other things that are going on in the community. If there's something that you want in particular to discuss or to raise, you can feel comfortable giving me a call down here at 217-359-5483. 217-359-5483, and I will be happy to take your question or to highlight the event that's going on for you tomorrow, or I mean that's going on this weekend. Lastly, there's an event that Sister Carol and I will be presenting tomorrow at the Bethel AME Church, right there on 4th and Park Street. Trying to make sure I have this definitely. The times and everything. I know we are on at 3:30, but I wanted to make sure I had the flyer here in front of me. All right, so this is Bethel AME Church Men's and Women's Day 2015. So we're going to be speakers at 3:30 tomorrow. Carol and I will be a part of the event, the Saving the Family, Men and Women Working Together to Save the Family. The co-chairpersons, Dante Lotz and Jonte Rollins, they've invited us to come and speak. So there's two events tomorrow. There's actually a 10:45 a.m. event, and then there's a 3:30 p.m. event. The 10:45 speakers are the Robinsons, Prince and Mallory. They will be speaking in the morning at 10:45, talking about saving the men and women working together. And then at 3:30 p.m., yours truly, Brother Aaron Ammons and Carol Ammons will be the speakers for the 3:30 p.m. event at Bethel AME Church, right on the corner of 4th and Park Street in Champaign. So hopefully you all will be able to come out and participate. All right. I always try to get all that stuff out in one good big breath. It's got so much stuff going on, man. So this microphone, this one right here. Yeah, just pull it on around there to you. And if you put those headphones on there. So I think the last thing that I have is to just remind folks to give us a call. We always want to try to repeat that number as many times as possible, because I'm sure there's something that will be stirred or spurred up in you, and we want to make sure that you have the opportunity to share your thoughts. Can you hear pretty good over there, George?
Too much.
Too much? All right. How's that? Is that better? All right, no problem. All right, so brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen out there, we have in the studio with me Mr. George Wissmiller. George is an ex-county board member in, I think, was it county board?
It was county board in DeWitt County.
County board in DeWitt County, yeah, yes. Yeah, that's what I was going to get to. All right, so yeah, DeWitt County county board member. For how many terms did you serve there?
Actually, I served a half a term. It was the I can't think of the word for it right now, but mm-hmm. It was when they reorganized, and some people served four, some people served 2 years.
Oh, okay.
I served two.
Okay, all right. And so, George, also, you are a retired police officer, am I correct?
That's correct, Champaign City.
Champaign City. So you know this area quite well, huh? Yes, indeed. All right, so, George, tell the people what you've been working, who you are, I guess a little bit about yourself and what you've been working on.
Okay, retired Champaign police officer. I've been active on this for between 7 to 8 years. I've never actually sat down and added it up. I suspect it would be depressing. Mm-hmm. I ran for state house in the 2008 election. I served on the county board. I'm vice president of WATCH, which is the original group that got involved in the Clinton landfill / Muhammad Aquifer issue. I'm coordinating with Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. Mm-hmm. I'm the author, although a couple other people actually do most of the writing, but I'm the name on the front of it, of a online publication called Troubled Waters about the Muhammad Aquifer and this issue.
Troubled Waters?
Troubled Waters, yes.
So you guys have been working on this for how long, George?
I've been working on it for, like I said, between 7 and 8 years. There are a couple of others, Dave and Sherry and Bill, who have been on it longer than I have, but not a whole lot, about a year longer than I have.
Okay. So most people in the area who are listeners out there are probably familiar with the Muhammad Aquifer and growing daily on our understanding of what the aquifer mm-hmm. is and all that type of stuff. So for the person who may not have a clear understanding of what the aquifer is, why don't we just take 2 or 3 minutes or however long it would take for you to explain to people what is an aquifer and what is the aquifer that we're talking about?
Okay, the Muhammad Aquifer is a huge, it goes under 14 counties, underground repository for water. And I say that and people picture a lake. It's not a lake. It's a sand and gravel aquifer. It's a pit of sand and gravel with water in it. It has been described by various organizations as pristine, as wonderful, as abundant, and all of those things are absolutely true. You know, all the problems that are out in California, we don't have those problems. We have this huge, wonderful, clean resource. Hmm. It is a result of the glacial age. That's what carved the pit that it's in. It should supply us for decades and decades and decades. It's something about this area that is unique and that is great.
So then when we talk about this aquifer, right, you said it's not like a lake like people envision, you know, Clinton Lake or Homer Lake or something like that. It's not that. It's different. It's underground, but it supplies good quality mm-hmm. water, pristine water, as we talk about, for 14 different counties, not yeah. just Champaign County, but Vermilion County and all the different counties surrounding us. It supplies water for those entire counties. So
that's not quite true. Some of the counties are only partly over the aquifer.
Okay. All right. So I always try to paint this picture. I took a tour with my son and my nephew, a couple of boys I took over to the sanitary district, of how we clean up the water and put it back into the lake, into the river, so that it makes its way back to the aquifer. And we learned that there are some places, many places in our country, where people drink from toilet to tap, which means the very same water that you flush your toilet with gets cleaned up and then at some point becomes the very water that you would drink out of your kitchen sink, right? Mm-hmm. But we're not in that situation.
No, we're not.
Right? So sometimes that helps us paint the picture for people of what your options would be if this Muhammad Aquifer was contaminated, because then what will we do if all these horrible PCBs and chemicals that we're going to discuss make their way into this pristine aquifer? Would we be able to use it anymore?
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, so those are the type of pictures that I try to paint for people to let them see that, you know, what you have now, how valuable it is, what you have now, and why people like you and Watch and others are fighting so hard to keep it from being contaminated. So let's go back then. Okay, go ahead. No, go ahead.
One more thing about the aquifer. You know, and this stuff, I've been dealing with it for so long that it's just obvious to me, and I don't think to talk about it, and okay. I have to remember to do it. People think, well, a river, an underground river, it's more like an underground lake. I was reading right before last, and I knew it took a long time for water to move from one end of it to the other.
Mm-hmm.
7,000 years. This stuff just barely seeps. It's, for all intents and purposes, stationary. Okay, now the 7,000 sounds a little extreme to me, but it was an authoritative source that I got that from.
Hmm.
But even if it's half that, you know, even if it's only 3,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people, you know,
that's how long it takes water to get into that aquifer? To flow through it.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Gold King Mine out west, you know, they had that horrible leak into the river that turned the river orange, and there mm-hmm. were heavy metals and all kinds of nasty stuff. And then about 10 days later, the U.S. EPA is basically saying, problem solved. And that's because the river washed all the stuff downstream and visited all these toxins on the people downstream. Hardly solved, but kind of resolved.
Uh-huh.
It's diluted. It's not an immediate threat. It's more of a long-term problem now.
Hmm.
That's not true of the aquifer. If we get some of these toxins into the aquifer, our kids, our grandkids, our great-grandkids, our great-great-great-great-great-grandkids are still going to be dealing with them. They'll still be there. This aquifer does not flush itself in any reasonable amount of time. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge consideration. It's completely and totally different from the situation with the river.
Okay. No, that's an important piece, because you're saying it, just as long as it takes for it to flow through, it probably takes just as long for those chemicals to come out of it.
Absolutely.
Wow. And, you know, to me, it's just a continuation of some very, you know, unintelligent decisions that we make in relationship to soil, water, air, because it's not some of the decisions we make. They're not sustainable. They don't sustain our own lives. You know, they create an opportunity immediately for some capitalist venture. Right. But they don't really or some profits to be made now. But they don't think about the sustainability and the long term effects of the generations to come. So
I could not have said it better myself.
Well, so here we go. What you guys are working on right now. So my understanding, I'm going to summarize it now. I want you to help me fill in where we are. So the DeWitt County Board has a landfill, basically, mm-hmm. that people dump into, just like we have in Danville, other places. Okay. Is that right?
That's the DeWitt County Board does not have a landfill. This is a private family-owned operation. It's owned by a family called the Coulters. Okay. The DeWitt Board has cited it, permitted it, authorized it, whatever. But it's not a county property.
Okay. So the family that owned it is the how do you spell it?
Coulters, Coulters.
Okay, the Coulters. So this is a privately owned.
Yeah, now the landfill itself is incorporated. They have to incorporate these landfills so they can declare bankruptcy and walk away from them when they start to leak.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole company is owned by the Coulter family.
Okay, so there's some other clarity there. So it's owned by this family, but it is incorporated,
mm-hmm.
and so they have to get the approval and things of the county board there and DeWitt to dump certain things there.
Yeah, to some extent, it's not hard to get from the DeWitt County Board, but yes.
Right, but I'm just saying that's the yes. process, right? Because yeah. we want people to understand the process, and I think we'll get into some of your concerns about the DeWitt County Board and how they function. I'm sure that'll come up at some point. So, so at this point, I'm just trying to carry people along in the conversation, because I know it can get complex. So I wanted to make sure that we were at least giving people the basics from the beginning and then just kind of let you get into it.
You know, and I'm not criticizing you at all, mm-hmm. but that's what the scientists and the lawyers and the politicians who are pushing this thing keep saying over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
It's complex. In fact, you heard it at the Urbana City yeah. Council meeting. You're not capable of understanding it. I have been saying for 8 years, I can explain to a 10-year-old in 15 minutes what's wrong with this, and people have a working knowledge of what's wrong with this.
Okay.
It's a dumb idea to put toxins over a drinking water aquifer.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%.
It's not complicated, really. They're making it complicated to confuse us.
Okay, so here we are. What we are right now, what we have, the situation is that the landfill exists. It's got some nasty stuff on top of it already, mm-hmm. right? And your group and many other groups are trying to stop, first and foremost, from anything else being put there,
mm-hmm.
right? And I guess depending on your perspective, actually Watch's concern is that you want everything that's there that's not supposed to be there to be removed.
And nothing new to come in.
But so when I sort of prioritize things for you guys, or when I'm thinking about it, it appears to me that your priority is to remove any PCPs or MGP, whatever, what do you call it?
MGPs.
MGPs away from there, because these are the really nasty toxins, poisonous stuff that will contaminate the water, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sure we can get into another conversation about things that are dumped on a landfill. But right now, these are the things that are most important right now that we are most concerned about. So Watch wants those things removed, right? This consent decree, now we're getting into this, what everybody's talking about right now, this consent decree that's being brought around to different government agencies and entities like the Urbana City Council, asking for us to sign off on it. Talk to us about that and what your concerns are about that.
Okay, a couple preliminary things on the consent decree. First of all, I want to make it real clear at this point, the consent decree is being pushed by the coalition attorneys. There are no coalition elected officials that have voted for this yet. There are very few that have even expressed an opinion about it. So at this point, the bone we're picking is with the attorneys.
Okay.
This consent decree purports to resolve almost all of the landfill issues. It addresses a few of them, but certainly not all of them. It's being presented as a partial solution, and that's correct. If it were a good thing, it would only be a partial solution. It's being hustled through in, I'm an independent, and my big overall thing is transparency. And this is making nuts. They know they've got a bad piece of paper. They know if the public finds out about it, it'll die a natural death. And so they're trying to hustle it through without the public knowing what's going on. If this gets approved, it authorizes, and we keep hearing different numbers, and this is typical of dealing with the EPAs and stuff, either 27,000 or 30,000 or 60,000 or 70,000 tons. That's 70,000 tons of high-level MGP toxic waste to remain in the landfill. That's nuts. we're agreeing to a toxic chemical waste landfill. That's all there is to it. You know, it's big lump of toxins in the landfill. That's a toxic chemical waste.
So when we were talking about this at the Urbana City Council and Mr. Hooker, the attorney, was coming to present to us, I walked away with this understanding, and I want you to show me this in this document. We talked about this before we came on air, that the stuff that's there now, the toxic waste that's there now, which, you know, again, visually, I want people to understand that this is not a big glob of black gooey stuff, right? It's actually dirt. Soil.
Yeah.
It's dirt that is contaminated with toxic stuff. And when the concern is that when it gets wet, it leaches, it bleeds down. Basically, it gets down into, or the grains of the dirt or whatever get down into our aquifer. Somehow it would contaminate the aquifer, right?
It's not nearly that simple.
Okay.
Okay, it is that simple, but it's not nearly that limited. The concerns are that it will leach down into the aquifer. You know, there we have a couple of plastic sheets and stuff we're probably going to go into later, protection. The force working against us is gravity. I'm thinking in the long run, gravity's going to prevail.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is also directly uphill from a river. The Salt Creek River. I live on the North Fork. It's about 1,000 yards uphill, or 1,000 feet uphill from this river. It has running water creeks on other two sides of it that run into the river. So on three sides of it, it has running water. The Salt Creek drains into the Illinois River, drains into the Mississippi just north of St. Louis. This stuff, it's perfectly conceivable that in a torrential downpour or some kind of a natural event, this stuff could go down that hill into that river. There's no reason to think it couldn't happen. There's absolutely no provisions for protection from that.
Hmm.
Okay? They had a cleanup in Clinton. It was an MGP cleanup. That's the stuff that's in there now. In fact, that some of the stuff that's in there now is from Clinton. At the site where they were cleaning up the MGPs, they built this huge big tent that covered a whole block, literally. They had big, huge machines that sucked air out of this tent so that it had negative pressure so that none of this stuff could escape. They had an airlock for the trucks to go in and out so that none of this stuff could escape. And then they hauled it out to the landfill and they dumped it in the open air with stuff billowing off of it. You know, something magical happened between town and the landfill. I don't know what, but air quality is another concern.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a concern all the way around. Now, the one that we're concerned with specifically right now is the aquifer, but it's important not to remember that there are other things going on, too.
Okay. All right. So at this point, this toxic soil that's above the Muhammad Aquifer, and we're concerned about it leaching and various different things that it could happen. It's there now. It's however many tons of it that's there is there now. And from what I understand, the consent decree is simply to stop anything further from being dumped there, which is one of the things that Watch wants, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Okay. So, but it does not cause and force a removal of what's there. And that's what you guys are absolutely opposed to. Am I correct?
It not only doesn't force a removal, it restrains the 14 governments from ever doing it in the future.
So could you show me, you said you had that piece there in the document. I wanted the people to be able to hear that because I think this is a very important point. Because even those people who are saying, hey, we've got the protections there, we've stopping it from going any further, what can we do if and when in the future we find that there's some concern, if there's an alarm that's raised and one of the protections that we have in place says, hey, this is seeping or it's leaking, what can we do about it? Talk to us about that now.
Okay, I'm reading directly from the consent decree. It's Section C, Local Government Plaintiff Stipulations, Paragraph 1. The local plaintiffs stipulate that each of them is resolving allegations of their complaint filed herein without requiring CLI to exhume the MGP source material currently disposed of in the CWU, that's Chemical Waste Unit, at the facility. And the local government plaintiffs stipulate that each of them will never require Clint Landfill Incorporated to exhume the PCB source material currently disposed of in the Chemical Waste Unit at the facility. I was on the county board. We dealt with a very minor issue that was kind of similar to this in a way. My understanding is it's illegal for this board, for this council, these boards, to impose restrictions on the future boards about how they can protect the citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not illegal, it's certainly unethical for this city council to say, well, in the future, you can't protect the citizens from this.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the glaring things in this thing.
And I do think this is one of the reasons why, you know, I'm supportive of us having a public discussion, why I wanted you to come on the show, because even if, because to me it sounds like that we couldn't, or the future DeWitt County Board could not force the current owners to clean it up. But there may be a process for US EPA or Illinois EPA that the people could force them to do the cleanup.
Well,
I don't know.
DeWitt County has their own agreement, which is much worse than this.
Okay.
If you want me to talk about DeWitt County, I can.
Well,
but this
I just want to make sure
County.
That we. Yeah, but, I just yeah, want to make sure we're as clear as possible to the people who are out there listening, and the concerns that you are bringing up are very clear and concise to
yeah.
people.
It constrains future governmental agencies, area governmental agencies, from intervening to have these MGPs. Our contention is, and a lot of experts' contention is, they will inevitably leak in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be next year. It might be in 100 years, probably more likely next year.
Mm-hmm.
When they leak in, not if they leak in, but when they leak in, we will be completely, totally dependent on the Illinois EPA and the US EPA to take care of the problem. We won't be able to intervene in any way to force them to be removed. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm not real confident in the US EPA and the Illinois EPA. I'd rather hang on to our ability to do something about it locally.
Mm-hmm. So our ability to do something about it locally, one could argue, we're in this position because basically, from what I'm reading, DeWitt County allowed toxins to be dumped into a landfill or aquifer. So that when it was in the hands of the people, so to speak, this is what happened. They allowed toxins to be put above the aquifer. What would you say to that?
I was extensively involved in DeWitt County. It is not the DeWitt County's people's fault. It's the DeWitt County board's fault. It's a small group on a prior DeWitt County board's fault.
Mm-hmm.
They had illegal meetings to set them up, illegal in violation of Open Meetings Act meetings. They discussed it in the Finance Committee, which nobody ever goes to the Finance Committee. When they voted on it, they put it on the agenda as approval of a railroad spur. Approving this toxic chemical waste landfill was on the DeWitt County agenda to be voted on. It was listed as approval of a railroad spur. And the language from what I haven't actually seen it, but the language from what I understand, talked mostly about a railroad spur, and it mentioned creating a toxic chemical waste landfill kind of almost as an afterthought. Wow. And they approved it. They're supposed to have a siting. They tried to do this up in Peoria, same company. They had, I think it was, they had a month or so of public comment period. They had hearings. They had all the stuff that they're supposed to have by state law. DeWitt County, none of that. So once DeWitt County got done approving this, it went to the Illinois EPA. The Illinois EPA either did or didn't, we can prove one way or the other, know that there hadn't been a proper siting. They went ahead and approved it. The Coulters told them, well, we had the siting hearings. No, they didn't. And now Illinois EPA, or after the fact, Illinois EPA was saying, well, we can't punish the Coulters because DeWitt County Board did something wrong, so we're going to ignore the fact that there wasn't the proper local procedure. DeWitt County, they're still trying to put the railroad spur in DeWitt County. And I've been talking to a bunch of people about this issue. And some of them are suggesting that we should forget about the consent decree because it's apparently a done deal, and I don't think it is, and concentrate on the railroad spur. My reaction to that is anything that DeWitt County can do to promote the Coulters business, they are going to bend the rules to do. It's a waste of time to try to object, to try to oppose them in DeWitt County. DeWitt County receives a huge amount of money from the land, you know, and I can explain, but I can't justify DeWitt County's attitude. They're a small county. They have a small tax base. They're not wealthy. They have grown dependent on having huge amounts of money coming in. They have the power plant, huge revenue source. They have a medical waste outfit, huge revenue source. And they have the landfill, which is a huge revenue source, and they've gotten spoiled. They've got more money than they know what to do with, and they've just gotten spoiled over the years. Now there's discussions about shutting down the power plant, and this landfill is threatened. And they're scrambling, trying to figure out where their money's going to come from.
So we can see where, you know, this wonderful thing called capitalism comes in, right? You know, so folks are in DeWitt are scrambling. It sounds like there's quite a bit of waste that goes through DeWitt County, or is being cleaned up or housed in DeWitt County. So that would be alarming to me just in and of itself. But you pointed out that there are profits, there are the tax benefits or whatever that the individuals that the county board gets out of it. And I think you've highlighted the importance of us making sure that we
I'm going to interrupt you. I don't have any evidence that any individuals are profiting from this thing.
No. That's not what I'm trying to say. No, I'm saying that the individuals who work, who are elected officials there, how important it is to make sure that we have elected officials who are going to stay in tune with the people, mm-hmm. who are going to listen to the concerns of the people and make sure that they are fully aware of what they're voting on and the impact that it has later on. So I'm just trying to say, continue a conversation that I've had for a long time with people who are the listeners out there about why it is important that we have elected officials who are going to read their packets, who are going to do their homework, who are going to stay in tune with people and make sure that we're thinking long term about the decisions that we make. So, you know, thinking about that and realizing how it was slipped in on some, and how some people may have been okay with voting for something like this because of the profit margins or because of what it would bring into the city coffers, right, is what I'm getting at. Not trying to say that any individual outside of the Coulters family was going to benefit personally from it.
Yeah, you're talking about the city's coffers, and county's coffers is actually what we're talking
the
about.
The county, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This consent decree has a section in it, I'd have to find it, but completely out of blue and completely unrelated to the issue, it mentions waste transfer stations in both Champaign and McLean County. these would be huge revenue sources for those two counties, which are the driving force, one of the driving forces behind the coalition. So basically, they're dangling an apple in front of the two of the biggest players in this thing, in this coalition, saying, approve this thing and it'll evolve into a revenue source for your county.
Okay, why don't you spend a little more time on that for a second, because that sounds like something new to me. You're saying that there's a transfer waste station that would be, that who would give?
Coulters.
The Coulters.
Yeah,
okay.
See, the Coulters right now, if you go out to 10, you'll see a steady stream of trucks. Area disposal, Clinton Landfill, several other companies are the same outfit, and they're all owned by the Coulters. There's also a lab that's owned by the Coulters. There's a steady stream of air disposal trucks going back and forth on the highway. They would either have a transfer station in Champaign County and one in McLean County where they can consolidate all the waste. This will be a very messy operation. Consolidate all the waste and then take it out there in bulk, either in semis or if they can get their railroad siding in trains.
Mm-hmm.
Much more efficient for them. Their bottom line has helped immensely.
So we have something like that already on North Lincoln Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that it would basically be something like that, but it would be specifically for
area.
The area. So we already have something like that in Urbana, and I'm sure that that gets loaded up into semis, and I'm sure it's taken to to the landfill, to DeWitt in DeWitt, right?
Yeah, and
or Danville, one of the two.
And we don't have any issue necessarily with the waste station, the transfer station. It's probably not a good idea. It's a messy operation, and there's dust, but that's not our issue.
Mm-hmm.
But we find it kind of, in fact, I mentioned this to the Champaign County Board when I spoke to them. We find it kind of offensive that this unrelated thing is brought in and dangled in front of two of the boards as, well, if you approve this thing, there's going to be a buck or two in it for the county.
And see, I don't quite understand why the city of Champaign, just like the city of Urbana, why do we need, or why would the county need the Coulters to create a transfer station here and then just transfer stuff over to the landfill through the semis? Why do the Coulters have anything to do with that?
Because the Coulters run the whole chain. Definitely a large percentage of the goods that's picked up in Champaign is picked up by Area Disposal. There's also a whole string of other companies, garbage companies, that are owned by Area Disposal. They pick up the garbage, they haul the garbage, they dump the garbage, they own the whole chain. Now, there are independents, but not very many of them.
Okay.
For the most part, they're the big dog. And so they're looking to make their operation more efficient. They would rather do long hauls in semis or trains than in individual garbage trucks.
Okay. So, all right. So here we are with this consent decree. And we have a document that is asking entities like the city of Urbana, the city council, to say, hey, listen, this is the best that we can get right now. We need you guys to vote in a majority to support the consent decree. As it stands right now, excuse me, my understanding after listening to you all the other night and the attorney is that it will stop any further toxins being dumped on this site.
Can I talk on that point for a second?
Sure.
Okay. Originally, it was PCBs. This is kind of like whack-a-mole. They're going to bring PCBs in there. We get it knocked down. Now they've got MGPs in there. We get that down. And then it's going to be coal ash. That's the next thing coming down the road. That's what the DeWitt County Agreement sets up. Where was I?
So what we're talking about is where we are with this consent decree, what's in there now, and what we're being asked to vote on is an agreement that would stop any further dumping of toxins in there. But you're saying that it'll stop the MGPs and the PCBs, but it will not stop something, some other particular.
No. And this whole thing is very confusing, especially for me. Some of the people that list themselves as the opposition to watch on this, and they've done that publicly, are friends of mine. They're people that I've worked with for years and years. I have a great deal of respect for. I can't imagine why they're trying to do this. And they won't talk to me about it. They won't talk to us about it. They're just pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. It's horribly confusing because I don't understand what's going on. I understand absolutely that this is a bad thing, but I don't understand why it's being pushed so hard. Two of the big things that the consent decree does do is it rules out the possibility of bringing in PCBs. It rules out the high-level PCBs. It rules out the possibility of bringing high-level MGPs. High-level PCBs have already been ruled out by the US EPA. No gain there.
Right.
High-level MGPs have already been ruled out by your wife's House Bill, House Bill 1326. No gain there. That's the two big things that it, and part of what's going on is this thing has been being negotiated for a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. And the
well, let me ask you this, because I do think we're getting to some what I feel like are some real points of clarity here. The U.S. or the U.S. EPA by making this a sole source, what prevents what was the agreement or what was the ruling that said you can't bring any further PCBs in here?
Under pressure, the Coulters agreed to withdraw their TSCA permit. So that's the end of the PCBs.
So the permit was withdrawn because of the activism, because of the work around it and the coalition and all those things.
And the coalition, And the coalition makes the point that, well, they could reapply. Yeah, they could reapply, but in the current environment and with the current level of public it ain't going to happen. Yeah.
So now the MGPs that you said the House bill that Carol sponsored and pushed forward stopped the MGPs from coming. They're done.
They're done.
So then you're saying that a consent decree, an actual agreement, basically, that no further none of these types of chemicals will be dumped. It's already a done deal. We don't need this decree to secure that anything further gets done there, that gets dumped there. So then what is the decree for?
First of all, in fairness to the attorneys, and I try to be fair here, while they were negotiating this decree, while they were negotiating those two things, these PCBs and MGPs were still a possibility. Both of those prohibitions are a very recent occurrence.
Okay.
So, you know, there's some confusion. There's some problems caused by the timing. But the fact is, those two provisions are now redundant.
So I want to give first a major shout out to all of you all who have been working diligently for years on these issues, because everybody can't be everywhere. And so to hear that basically the organizing and the public outcry is the source of the withdrawing of the permit for the PCBs, is a major victory for organizers, right? You know, and for people still saying that we can get together and we can stop some things when we organize. And then I have to give a shameless plug for this wonderful lady that I love dearly, State Representative Carol Ammons, for her House bill that helped stop the MGPs. But on a very serious note, when we were talking about our water supply, right? And so we need to make sure that we are educating people about how important this is. And you just drove home a point for me that I really think needs to cause people to pause for a minute. I negotiate contracts. I'm on my union as a president of my union. So if I don't, once the PCBs and the MGPs come off the table, I don't need to negotiate them anymore, right? So what is it that you're going to give me? Now I want coal ash or something, but I'm not going to sit here and give away my right to hold you accountable and to hold future generations hostage, and they can't do anything about it, and future elected bodies hostage and say that they can't address these concerns over a leverage point that I've already won. It doesn't make sense to me either. So I'm definitely going to have to get some further understanding of what this is, you know, because to me, there's no remediation in this decree. There's no we've already got two things that we were fighting for already accomplished. and we have the sole source designation. What exactly does the decree get us? I don't get it. Yes, indeed.
That's our point exactly. There's no substantial benefit to the people here, and there are downsides. We lose quite a bit. One of the big things is we lose the ability to intervene in the future and force those things to be taken out. Now, they've defended that. They've defended leaving them there two ways. First way, they said, well, it wasn't realistic to expect those to be pulled out. My counter to that was, so it's realistic to gather these things up. It's realistic to haul them all over the state. It's realistic to dump them on top of our aquifer, but it's not realistic to haul them off the top of our aquifer. They dropped that argument.
Mm-hmm.
Now their argument is that it would damage the liners, damage the protections. I could go on about these protections, quote unquote, for an hour and a half. But it would damage to remove these. And that's probably true. They were careless. I've got pictures where they tore up the linings, putting them in. There's no reason to think that they wouldn't be careless and tear things up, pulling them out. But if they're not there, why are we concerned about damage to the liners?
If they're not there, what do you mean?
If we haul the PCBs out, why do we care what kind of shape the protection's in if there's nothing there left there to protect from?
So so let's talk about this for a minute. The amount of waste that's there. Then is it possible to say, okay, if we've got, let's say we've got 70,000 tons of this stuff that's sitting mm-hmm. there. Is it possible for us to just remove 60,000 tons of it so we don't even get near the liners? I mean, I'm just trying to envision this. The average person, in my opinion, I think of a big, huge tub of plastic liners or something, and then they dumped all that nasty stuff inside of those things, and they're supposed to protect it from leaking out. Well, I'm thinking that the same operations that they use to dig the stuff up wherever they dug it up from, they can come and dig it out, mm-hmm. put it back on those trucks and take it someplace that's not over an aquifer or something like that, right? And if you're concerned about tearing the sides or the bottom, then don't get that close to them. So there would be some left. There wouldn't be the amount.
And that's absolutely correct. My argument goes beyond that. If you take all of them out of there, if you take all 70,000 tons out, then you don't care about the protections anymore because there's nothing there to protect. Mm-hmm. You know, just if you eliminate the problem, then you don't have to allow for the problem anymore.
Right. I guess what I'm getting at, I mean, because literally, I'm talking about, like, if I have a plastic container and I'm trying to dig stuff out of it, if I'm concerned that the machinery that I use is going to scrape, going to burst, going to tear the liner itself, and something is going to be left behind and seep in there, then if I don't know, I just, if the concern, I'm just strictly talking about how do you do this operation without disrupting, tearing, destroying the liners that it's in when you're trying to clean all of that stuff out there?
Okay, these are long-term threats. They're not short-term threats.
Okay.
They're not something that's going to happen in 24 hours.
Okay.
They haul that stuff out of there. Once it's out of there, you don't have to worry about the liners having been damaged. If you take it out of there, the threat's gone.
But see, I'm saying damaging the liners while you're removing it
with
heavy equipment and stuff.
That's not an issue.
It's not. Why not?
Because while you're removing it, if a little bit of it gets through into the dirt, there are protections there they will protect. There's some clay under the thing. There's quite a bit of it's going to get through for the week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or a month that it takes to get that stuff out of there.
So you said that if that you're more confident that the protections that are in place, the liner, the clay, the detectors, type of thing that we have to sample the water and stuff, would be sufficient for after the cleanup, that if there was some residue left behind or some tearing of the liner or something, is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying you need to get all of them out of there.
Yeah.
Like a Superfund site. Clean them up and clean them up right. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had stuff in your backyard, you would remove all of it, and then they would test the soil, and if it wasn't all out, they'd remove it again, test mm-hmm. the soil, remove it again. Get it all out of there.
Okay.
Do it all at once. Do it well. People are supervising. Do it well. It's being tested on a regular basis. Do it well. The public's watching. Do it well. The elected officials are watching.
Mm-hmm.
Do it all at once. It's gone. Then you don't care about the liners. Mm-hmm. Then you can go forward for 1,000 years and not have to worry about the stuff leaking into the aquifer, even if the liners are trashed,
mm-hmm.
because the stuff isn't there to begin with.
No, I definitely can yeah. understand it from the perspective that it's all gone, yeah. right? If you can get it all out of there. Because I've never done this type of yeah. operation, what I envision is a big crane coming through, scooping this stuff, putting it on a truck, right? You know, you got the big... whatever you call it,
but payloaders,
so it's digging the dirt out and it's putting it on the trucks, and you've got all these high tech equipment around to keep it from floating all over the place, just like they did in Clinton, right? But as you're digging this stuff up, at some point the operators are saying, okay, we're getting close to the yeah. sides, we're getting close to the bottom, and so what do you send people down there now with shovels and you carefully dig the stuff up? Then they're going to keep digging with those big, so they're going to tear or rip.
You go ahead and trash the liners. Who cares? You're digging the stuff out.
Okay. So I guess what I'm getting at is that's such a messy operation that those things, when they're digging into soil or big, into the ground, they're not precise.
No.
So there's going to be at some point, I would say that, I mean, the shovels or the big machinery themselves will be contaminated with the soil, right?
Absolutely.
So every time they dig into some fresh soil, they're putting toxins into the fresh soil. So there's going to be some residue left behind in that soil, regardless of to how you dig it out.
Considerably less than 70,000 times.
I agree with you 100% there. And that's when I was saying that. So we would have to rely then on the clay underneath, on the wells and testing and stuff like that to try to keep that stuff from slowly filtering in. But it would be much less of an issue and concern about
much
the magnitude of contamination.
I can go along with much less of an issue and concern. Me personally, I think it's not an issue and concern.
Okay.
I've reviewed some of these Superfund sites. I've reviewed some of these cleanups. I've seen the way they do it. They are this... cleanup we had in downtown Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
They are meticulous. They clean up, they test. If it's not all gone, they clean up some more, they test it again. They're very meticulous about it. This is one mm-hmm. thing that the EPAs do fairly well.
Well, you know, we've had some interactions with the Illinois EPA and to some degree the US EPA about the Fifth and Hill site.
Yeah.
And then when we were working on it and a partner with the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers on it, CU Citizens for Peace mm-hmm. and Justice. So, but there's still concern even if, so we know that these are long-term fights and, you know, they don't want to clean them up.
You can't get all of it. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, the little bit that's left after a conscientious cleanup is a much, 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 much better situation. And I can't along with, you know, I'm speaking for myself and mm-hmm. not the group, I can't go along with deliberately leaving any of it there.
I mean, I feel the same way. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I struggle trying to understand. This is where I'm at with this, is that the cleanup that we're talking about right mm-hmm. now, is I want that done today, okay, mm-hmm. right? You know, and to be placed someplace that is not going to be over a, you know, can we put in a desert someplace? You know, I don't know, right?
Or so, they've got,
But my point that I want to get to is that this, the one issue that troubles me, that I still can't wrap my head around at this point is, what the attorneys are saying is that this legal, the lawsuit and stuff that we have that's pending is never going to result in a cleanup. That's a different process.
That's a different process.
So then on that notion, from that perspective, then the only thing that stops me or doesn't, makes me not want to vote for the consent decree is that it doesn't have enough teeth, because the two things that we wanted to stop have already been stopped. Why am I signing an agreement with you to stop the two things that we've already stopped? I want more. Mm-hmm. Right. If you tell me that, you know, you're going to stop coal ash from coming in, and you're going to give me the opportunity to hold you accountable for a cleanup. I mean, if you give me something like that, then I understand consent decree. And but I can't give up the rights for future generations to fight this thing and to hold you accountable. I can't give up prevention of some new chemical coming in. We don't want any toxins, period. And so although coal ash is not being considered or being categorized as toxic at this particular point, we're certainly headed in that direction, right? So why would we open the door for something else like that, you know? So I don't know if I'm a whole lot clearer, but I do think there's a couple of points that you pointed out. The fact that the PCBs and the MGPs were already negated. Mm-hmm. And so we can't tout them to individuals or to the government bodies as accomplishments of this decree, because they were already done. Right. And wanting very specific and clear language about accountability and how long we can hold someone accountable. And I heard the term 60 years come up in the conversation Monday night, that we would have a 60 year period in which either the Coulters or someone is accountable for any leakage or spills or anything for that site. Did you want to talk about that at all? Do you have any thoughts on that?
We've been through this the whole 8 years with different forms of pollution. These things have half-lives. The half-life is, I don't know what it is for sure, but it won't be gone in 60 years.
And when we talk about half-life, you're talking about the toxicity of the substance.
Drops,
some of
yeah.
it breaks down and some of it does not very quick. Some of it yeah. breaks down quickly and some of it breaks down much slower.
Yeah, PCBs essentially never break down. Okay. MGPs, they do break down, but they don't break down very fast. 60 years is not going to cover it. That's a joke.
So MGPs are manufactured gas products, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
They're a toxic sludge of back when they used to burn coal mm-hmm. to make gas.
Mm-hmm. It created this tar and this nasty substance.
Nasty tar, and it's full of heavy metals. It's got
benzene.
It's got... You know, and we've
these things cause yeah. cancer.
And we've got liners out there. Mm-hmm. These are plastic liners. They're designed to contain PCBs. They're not designed to contain MGPs. So why are we worried about damaging them if they're not going to work anyway?
Right.
Benzene, which you just brought up. You know, go back to high school chemistry. What happens when you dump benzene on top of plastic?
It eats it up.
It goes right through it just like a knife through butter. You know,
wow.
I'm not worried about that protection, because the protection, I can do an hour and a half on what's wrong with those protections. They're mm-hmm. essentially worthless.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such an important topic, and we spent quite a bit of time talking about it at the Urbana City Council last Monday. I learned some things. There's some things that I still want to try to flush out in my own head. I appreciate you taking some time coming down this morning to talk about it. It's already been 45 minutes, and we really... we're just getting warmed up. I want to encourage anyone out there who's listening to give us a call at 217-359-5483, 217-359-5483, or 217-359-6545. We're going to probably go on for another 10 minutes or so. And I do want to hear from the people, though. I'd like to see if there's anyone out there listening who has an opinion, who has a question that they'd like to ask either one of us, or a concern that you'd like to raise. Give us a call, 217-359-5483 or 217-359-6545. So on the way out, George, what are you thinking about? What would you like the people to know who are listening?
I would like the people to know what is going on. And that's, I've been involved in government all of my adult life. A real, and this is important. It sounds almost like a joke, but it's important. If government's trying to do something quick, fast, and in a hurry, they're probably trying to do something that they shouldn't be doing. It's almost an absolute rule. The transparency on this thing, the open government on this thing has been horrific. It has been absolutely a joke. Dave Holt and I went to the Champaign City Council meeting. At the Champaign City Council meeting, they started talking about how transparent they were being, and then they mentioned that they were going to release the consent decree to the public on the 28th. That's yesterday. Mm-hmm. And vote on it the 1st. So the public would have access to the document 3 days before the council voted on it. I went home and filed a FOIA. This was, this was a week ago, something like that. I immediately went home and filed a FOIA for the consent decree. I was going to put it up on my website. And the next day, magically, it appeared on the city's site. Mm-hmm. So I forced him to post it early. This whole thing started with a meeting down this was a meeting of the lawyers. We don't know for sure who was there, and representatives of some or all of the members of the coalition. The meeting was not advertised. There was a summary circulated at the meeting. We got a copy of it under the table. It's the only reason we got one. We could have FOIA'd it. It's a FOIAble document, except we didn't even know it existed. It was so secretive. Mm-hmm. This whole thing could have been out in front of the public. It was decided, and they were moving forward on the 11th. It could have been put out in front of the public the 11th. Mm-hmm. Instead, they waited as long as they possibly could. I've got a letter here. You mind if I go through this?
Go ahead.
This is from Dorothy David, the city manager. It's dated August 28th, 2015. That's yesterday. I just got it last night. I actually haven't had to read the whole letter yet. But I went through, and I'm big on transparency. And Section H, which is titled Community Input, caught my attention. There's three sentences. I'd like to go through it and talk about each of the sentences if I could. Community input. The key features of the proposal have been the subject of a great deal of discussion among the members of the public who have been following the events concerning the landfill since the details of the settlement between CLI and DeWitt County were made public earlier this year. Okay, so for community input on the consent decree, they're listing public discussion of another document altogether prior to when the consent decree was available to the public. First sentence has nothing to do with community input on this. Absolutely nothing. Second sentence. David Wentworth and city staff discussed the details of the proposed settlement with representatives of the coalition at a luncheon meeting conducted on Tuesday, August 11th, 2015. This is the meeting I was just talking about. It was the equivalent of a closed session, except it wasn't a closed session. I have an Open Meetings Act complaint filed on it. The public was not invited. The public didn't know what was going on. The document that was released as a result of this meeting was not released to the public, but that's part of the community input paragraph. The last one. It is anticipated that all the local governments participating in the coalition will have their respective councils or boards consider the proposal at public meetings, so the proposal will have received a great deal of public scrutiny by the time all of the members have acted on it. I've been to a number of city council meetings, a fairly large number of city council meetings and county board meetings in my time. Unless there's something this as well as I do. Unless there's something special going on, you're lucky to get 10 people there.
Right.
They're not going to make a special effort to announce this thing that affects the aquifer and the safety of 850,000 people. They're making no effort to publicize it at all. So by airing it at these meetings, which is what they're doing, they're airing it in front of 10, 15, 20 people.
Or whoever might be watching at that time. Right. But something, your point, I think, that you're making, what I'm hearing, is that you said something of this magnitude certainly requires far more attention and public scrutiny or opportunity for advertising of what's going on
than
that.
They're essentially kind of negatively citing a toxic chemical waste landfill. They're not saying that we're going to allow this in the future. They were saying, well, this already exists and we're going to leave it to stay. If the US EPA or the Illinois EPA made provisions for toxic chemical waste landfill, they would be required by law to have a lengthy, well-advertised, well-publicized public comment period, a website explaining the issue, public meetings.
Mm-hmm. But all types of information and opportunities for people to come and speak.
And this is just not happening on this. This is being done as quiet, you know, and the staff of the coalition has made the point that, well, it's going to be out there for almost a month. Yes, it will, because that's the quickest they can possibly do it if they hurry everything they possibly can. Mm. They've got 14 entities to deal with meetings on, so the quickest they can do it is a month.
Well, so there's a a lot going on here, as we can all see, and we want to try to keep the public aware of what's going on, but you all have to be involved. I was trying to pull up the date on the next meeting here. But you all have to be involved. You have to express your concerns. You have to come to the meetings. So the Urbana City Council will be considering this again when we meet in September. I think it's September 8th is our next meeting. Good morning, caller. You're on the air. Oh, wait a minute. Go ahead.
I applaud your steadfastness on this. I attended a while back, and what I was curious to find out is that, you know, the Coulters are powerful, but I think there's a whole lot of other corporate interests behind this, and there's a group called the Shaw Group, and it was Shaw Environment that did the environmental study that said that this would be eternal or whatever they suggested, 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And they are a big outfit. They're involved in nuclear power.
Absolutely.
They're the people that are behind this barricade that's supposed to stop all the water in New Orleans on this canal. It's an untested concept. It's not being used in other places where they have this kind of a problem. They're very, very shady. And I don't know. I just wanted to highlight the fact that this is bigger than Coulters, and it seems to me that there's got to be some kind of reopener on this consent decree. You can't just, like you say, sign away any ability to object in the future. So, thanks very much.
You bring up an excellent.
Thank you, Paul.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
You bring up an excellent point. There's so many things here that I can't possibly talk about all of them, but the attorneys and the environmental engineers and the scientists who study this, I don't mean as derogatory as it sounds, but I refer to them as hired guns. They're businessmen, and they will work for whoever's willing to sign a contract with them. The coalition doesn't have very big pockets, and they're probably a one-shot client. The Illinois EPA has huge pockets, and they are going to come back over and over and over and over again. The Coulters have problem after problem after problem with the landfill. They're going to come back. Shaw wrote the application for the chemical waste unit. Mm-hmm. Huge, huge, big amount of money, and they know there's going to be repeat business.
Yeah.
So these people, they're not going to want to irritate the repeat business.
Well, George, again, I want to thank you for coming down. I want to thank you for all of your efforts on this and all the members of Watch and all the different coalition members, because a lot of people have been working on this now for a long time. But you guys, you know, you're all the time, you're keeping your eye, the critical eye, even on this process as it goes through, where those who have been allies up to this point, you see them now at this particular point, not as enemies, but you don't agree next step of what's going on at this point. So there's been a lot of work going on with this, and I just want to thank you for coming down and sharing some time with us. Yeah, go ahead. Final
point. Can I end?
Yeah.
The coalition, sole source designation, wonderful thing. That's thanks entirely to the coalition. Mm-hmm. The coalition, the elected officials in the coalition, are responsible for progress in this. We don't have a problem with the coalition per se. We don't have any problem at this point with the elected officials in the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very specific problem with this one document.
Okay. All right. So where do we find the document again? Where people can...
It's on the Urbana website. If you look at the previous committee of the whole meeting, you click on it. It's right there. I'm going... to have a website. In fact, I've got a website at www.dewittcounty, that's DEWITTCO.org/coalition. Currently, there's only a, you know, I work on my own time and my own dime. Currently, there's just a calendar of all the 14 entities' meetings.
Okay.
I'm hoping by Monday morning I will have a website up there with all of the pertinent documents.
But right now we can find it on the Urbana City Council.
Champaign and Urbana.
So anyone who's interested, you can actually read the entire document for yourself and have some input. And I think the Urbana City Council will be talking about this again at our next meeting, which is the what is our next meeting?
I don't know right off.
I'm trying to see. It's the first one in September.
I got so many meetings bouncing around in my head.
I think it's the 8th, but that doesn't sound right to me. No, because September 7th is the is Labor Day, so it's probably on you, man. All this stuff starts running together on me,
sure
too.
Sure does.
So it would look like September 14th is the next time we would meet. Tuesday, September 8th is going to be the next time that we meet, because we'll meet the day after Labor Day. So I want to make sure that folks know that they can come out, and I think we'll be discussing it then as well. So again, thank you.
One more quick thing.
All right.
Champaign County Healthcare Consumers is sponsoring on September 19th a meeting at the Champaign Library. This is a big deal. By then, it may be too late to stop the consent decree in this area. They're trying to rush it through before this meeting to limit the amount of publicity that it gets. Why wouldn't they wait till after the 19th if they wanted it aired publicly? But it's still going to be an important meeting. We can still interfere with the passage of this thing in the other entities. There's 14 of them all total. It's not all Champaign County. I encourage everybody to come to this meeting. We had a meeting about the sole source designation. We had something like 250 people there. Subtly, but very, very really, that number had a huge impact on the process. Mm-hmm. Just an absolutely huge impact.
Well, I definitely want to say that I have been educated through this process. From the stickers that I love, Aquifer and all that kind of stuff, to just an understanding of how an aquifer operates, how important it is. I mean, there's just been a ton of stuff that we have learned about landfills and toxic waste. So the education that has come from the mobilizing and the organizing is also very instrumental. We have to make sure we transfer this knowledge on to other people. So that's why I'm glad you came down to the show. I'm glad we had able to take some time to talk about this, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more in the future. So I just want to encourage you, brother, to keep on keeping up the good fight. And I appreciate everything that you're doing, and I'm sure I'll be talking to you soon. Thank George Wismiller, you all from WATCH, one of the organizations. What does WATCH stand for?
It stands for We're Against Toxic Chemicals.
We're Against Toxic Chemicals. All right. I like that. So, again, you all stay tuned. Go check out the document. You can see it on the Champaign, City of Champaign's website, or the City of Urbana's website, the consent decree that we were talking about this morning. And thank you for coming down here again, George. So, listen, I'm going to take a quick break, you all, and come back. I'm actually going to play a clip of Amelia Boynton Robinson talking about the importance of voting, and well, actually this clip is talking about her advice to young African Americans. So after this, I'll be back to talk more about Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson.
What advice would you want to give to young African Americans?
Number one, be proud of yourself. Go to the mirror and realize that you are facing one of the greatest persons God made, because he has never made a mistake in making human beings. All of us, every young person, or everybody, has some potential. Find out what that is and let nothing stop you. But first, be proud of yourself. Don't try to be like somebody else. Develop those potentials you have within you. Have self-respect. Have race pride. And nothing can stop a person from going to the top of whatever he wants to be. That would be my suggestion. Self-esteem is very important.
Why do you think it is that so many young black people have a hard time having that self-esteem, having that sense of pride?
They don't love themselves. That's the whole thing. They don't love themselves. If you were to go to a group of kids 5 or 6 years old and ask them, "Who would you like to be like?" They'll name somebody else. Never I want to be like me, like myself. I don't think you'll find one kid that'll say, "I want to be like me, I want to be like myself." They always want to be like somebody else. And that's the reason why. That's what I can see. There may be other reasons. But they're not happy with themselves.
All right, y'all. So that was a statement by the late, great Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, talking about and giving her wisdom and her perspective and her advice to young African Americans. Listen, to Sandra and Kevin, I'm going to get this down pat, but my underwriting announcement that I'm supposed to do at 8:30, again, I got deep into a conversation and just didn't do my job, and I apologize. So Kevin Elliott Counseling. This hour of programming is brought to you by Kevin Elliott Counseling, with a diverse group of 30 licensed therapists providing individual, group, family, and marital therapy. Kevin Elliott Counseling is located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown Champaign. For more information, call 217-398-9066 or see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. Again, this hour of programming is brought to you by Kevin Elliott Counseling, located at 309 West Clark Street near downtown Champaign. You can give them a call at 398-9066 or see Kevin Elliott, ELLIOTT, counseling.com. All right, y'all. So it has been my pleasure and my honor. I have learned so much and have just been just so appreciative of the opportunity to sit with people like Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, who we call Queen Mother, and hear her share her wisdom and what motivated her. So many of you out there may not be aware that when we talk about the civil rights movement, we hear a lot of conversation about, you know, Dr. King and what was going on with the, you know, the Montgomery bus boycotts and all the Voting Rights Act and the those types of things. But the reality is that it was this amazing woman, Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, who was out doing this type of work and tilling the soil, so to speak, for the success of the civil rights movement and its charismatic leaders like Dr. King and Reverend Bevel and some of the other folks who are a little more well known. But Miss Boynton was there when it was before the voting rights movement. When she was 21 years old, she lived to be 104. So when you do the math, she was registered to vote before the voting rights movement took place. She had already been working in Dallas County and other places on the voting rights and getting black people the right to vote. And she was registered herself, and she was a target for a long time. She was a businesswoman. She had already been pushing the needle and challenging the status quo and showing the courage and leadership that was necessary to gain the right to vote and to gain to fight for dignity for black people. I'm going to read you a few quotes of people who had an opportunity to work with her, to work side by side with her, and to receive her guidance as she moved forward. So the roots of the Selma Right to Vote movement, which politically enfranchised the African-American people and advanced the cause of freedom and justice for all people, can be traced back to the seed planted by Amelia Boynton when she began her voter registration work in 1929. Again, I would say that Miss Amelia Boynton began her voter registration work in 1929. Let me thank Amelia for allowing me to receive the freedom fruit from the tree she was wise and loving enough to plant. And that's from Reverend James Bevel, former director for Nonviolent Direct Action and SCLC, and director of the Right to Vote movement. I cannot remember when I didn't know Amelia Boynton Robinson, a remarkable, strong-willed, college-trained black woman who led a dedicated and dangerous civil rights struggle in Selma. Many years before Martin Luther King Jr., she once told me that the reason that she came to Selma, well, Dr. King once said that he told Ms. Robinson that she was the reason that he came to Selma. She continued the struggle after King and the organizations left. Her faith, courage, intelligence, and devotion are extraordinary, and the manner in which she used them say so much about the real America. This powerful book of her life should be required reading in the White House, the Congress, and every school and college in America. The nation owes Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson much. J.J. Chestnut, the author of Black and Selma. So it goes on and on about people talking about Miss Boynton and what her contributions were to the movement and to America. So this is a tribute to Miss Boynton. Within a land I've lived and dined, and all its riches freely mine. Here shines one day, yet come what may, for all my folly passed away. My Savior came and walked with me. Such sweet communion here have we. He gently led me by his hand. Child, this is heaven's borderland. The music that was sung for me, great songs of heaven's melody, as angels on their white-robed throne joined in the sweet redemptive song. O heavenly land, sweet heavenly land, as on the highest mount I stand, I looked way across the sea, where mansions are prepared for me and all mankind who love thee. This was a poem written by Marianna Wirtz for Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, September 2002. So I met Miss Boynton a few years ago in Alabama at a conference, a civil rights conference, basically bringing folks back together. It was the first time that I met her. And I realized that she was the matriarch of it when I saw that it was her courage that had pushed the envelope and pushed other people to get involved, because they saw this strong-willed black woman who was willing to put her very life on the line to further the cause that she believed in. So many of you can think back to and talk about the 60s. You know, we say the 60s and how brutal the 60s were. Well, can you imagine how brutal it was in 1929 or in 1930 for a black woman? We talk about the sexism and the racism that exists. Can you imagine what courage and dignity and commitment she had to be walking and doing voting registration in 1929, before the cameras, before the movement of the civil rights movement and all of the fervor that surrounded it, to be out there in the sun, to be out there in the heat and in the dangerous terrain that was existing in 1929 in the South. I mean, you just sometimes have to paint a picture and go back into a space and a place where, can you imagine what that had to be like? Some of you won't even get out and fight for these rights now. And it's much different than it was then. So In this book, it talks about her growing up in the South. And the book that I'm reading from is called Bridge Across Jordan. Bridge Across Jordan. This is her book, basically her autobiography. This is the same woman that many of you, as we talk about the book, the movie Selma, she was certainly portrayed, I would say, fairly in the movie Selma and her role, but not prominent enough as to what her role was in the movement. But this is the woman that you see in the pictures who was knocked unconscious on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We see all these folks going back to Edmund Pettus Bridge. We just had this huge 50-year anniversary, and President Obama was there. But it was this woman who in 1929 was registering black people to vote. It was this woman who led, whose seed planted, whose courage planted the seed that led to the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Act and the Voting Rights Movement, which led to your first black president. So in respect for and in honor of her legacy, certainly President Obama, she was invited to a couple of different events where she was celebrated, and she was sort of featured in this whole piece. When he went back to the 50-year anniversary, she was there with him going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and he was thanking her for her work. There's a video of her having the opportunity to vote for him in 2008. And then when the State of the Union address, she was also invited there. And there's a conversation that I'm going to play a clip of that with of her at the celebration, at the State of the Union address. I'm trying to find the right clip. It's I think she was interviewed by she wasn't interviewed by Al Sharpton, but she was on with, he was featuring her on his show. So take a listen.
Tonight we mark the passing of a civil rights icon. Amelia Boynton Robinson died today at the age of 104. All her life, she blazed new trails. In 1964, she became the first woman to run on a Democratic ticket in Alabama and the first black woman to run for Congress in the state. The next year, she helped lead the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in what came to be known as Bloody Sunday. She was left beaten, bloodied, and unconscious, captured in this iconic picture that helped draw attention to the movement. Recently, her story was featured in the Oscar-nominated film, Selma. Earlier this year, Alabama's first elected black congresswoman, Terry Sewell, invited Boynton Robinson to be her guest at the State of the Union. Before the president's speech, she talked to me about her hopes for a generation of activists fighting discrimination.
They are Americans, and to act like it, to work like it, and to demand that every segment of discrimination be torn away from this country that is supposed to be the land of the free, the home of the brave.
In March, I was honored to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge with Ms. Boynton Robinson and the president to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Selma March. Today, her son said the fight for civil rights was her life's purpose. When you look at a life spanning over a century and a life that did so much for so many for so long, it challenges all of us to not only uphold what she and others gave their life for, but to stop making excuses based on what age or stage we are in life. She used every moment to make the nation and world better. She never complained about she was in her 80s, 90s, over 100. She kept going, and she kept her movement going, and she kept her country getting better. God bless Amelia Boynton Robinson with long life. And she blessed us with a life of service. Thanks for watching. I'm Al Sharpton. Hardball starts right now.
So, that was the clip from Brother Al Sharpton, and then you heard her in her voice talking about what she thought was the concern or the issue for young African Americans. So in her own voice, she talks about the need to remove discrimination, all forms of discrimination from the society and from the culture that we live from our country here in North America. So Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, I just wanted to say thank you for everything that you gave us, everything that you provided for us, and as far as leadership and guidance. And, you know, she lives on in a lot of folks. So she touched a lot of lives in her favorite place was Tuskegee. She lived right down the street from Tuskegee University. She loved that place. And she said that was always her favorite place to be, was there in Tuskegee, Alabama. And it was just so, I mean, I don't know, whenever you talk to this lady, we sitting in her house talking to her about her accomplishments and her work. Go ahead, caller, you are on the air.
Hello. This is Donnie Fraser. How are you guys doing?
Chief, we are doing absolutely amazing. I'm sitting here just full talking about the Queen Mother, and I played a clip of her, and I said, wow, now this is just amazing. Not talking about her life and everything that she's done, but to see you pushing her across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, standing next to Al Sharpton and President Obama, and realizing that you were in our community just a few short years ago talking about your work, and there you were being the soldier that you are, protecting the Queen Mother and being there with her all through those last days. And I just wanted to say to you, brother, personally, the way you model being a father and being a man, and the way that you stood by her side and was there with her through everything in those last years was so honorable. And it just touched me to see you, Chief, still there. And I realized at that moment what you were doing. And I just wanted to say thank you, man. So that's why I reached out to you this morning. And I also wanted you to say anything that you wanted to say about her and about what you've been doing with her for the past couple of years.
Well, my brother, I tell you, that bridge thing was a trickle-down blessing, because there's no way that I could have been where I was at that spur of the moment without her. And that told me that God was watching that situation, and he wanted to allow me to experience the situation because of what I had done for her, what I was doing for her, and what I intended to keep on doing for her for as long as she breathed on this earth. Now, we came together about 15 years ago. You know, I was chief of police here in Tuskegee, and the council figured I was too effective, shutting down too many crack houses too fast. And Queen Mother and about 400 other people protested that dismissal when they decided to get rid of me. And that was a magnetic attraction in God's doing, because from that day forward, we stayed together. And Queen Mother was totally independent during about 12 or 13 of those years. But then she got into their old age period, and I had never in my life dealt with a person over 100 years old. But that was a total experience, because she was independent, she was determined, she was absolute about what she wanted to do, didn't want to be ruled, bossed, and controlled by nobody for nothing, and she had demonstrated that all of her life, everywhere, from 9 years old on up. And trying to protect her from herself at that old age was a major chore. And it got me chewed out many, many times by her. But you know, I had to do what I had to do because I had to keep her safe from herself. And then my police experience for 27 years enabled me to assist in protecting her from all the other evils around her. You know, the Doris Seekers, the treasure hunters, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me understand that God just put me there to do what I had to do. And then once I committed and once I realized that it was God's wish and will, then I knew I better do the best that I could do, man, because if I didn't, God don't like ugly, and I would be in trouble. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think back to the times we visited, and that you were always there, you know, in the house, and some of those things you don't recognize from the outside looking in. I remember Rev told us one time that, you know, the historical capital that people like Mr. Boynton, that Miss Boynton or Coretta Scott King or Reverend Bevel, any of those, Julian Bond, any of these individuals who were who received notoriety and who were major pioneers in the civil rights movement, the historical capital can be cashed in, right, for books and all kind of different stuff. And, you know, and so there are people coming, like you said, to unearth that treasure and to get a hold to those artifacts and those things that could be valuable, even if they want them for good reasons. Right. They those things have to be handled with delicacy and handled with care. And so when I can't think of a better soldier who was going to be on point, who was going to understand what was going on and to be able to handle her strong spirit as well as be firm to keep things intact the way that you did. And I'm just deeply moved at this very moment that you would give of your time. I mean, you're a grandfather, you're a father, you're a husband, but you made that sacrifice. And I just wanted to say thank you, brother.
And my wife did too, man, because there came a time, you know, when she had that first stroke that the doctor insisted that she either had to go with relatives who she did not really want to go with or to a nursing home where she could receive 24/7 care. And the only way that she could come back to her home here in Tuskegee would be that somebody would have to commit to 24/7 care. So, you know, Harriet Oliver, her right arm caregiver, man. And then Pamela Duncan, her left arm caregiver. And myself, we all have family. And all of us, our whole family, sacrificed the three of us to Mrs. Amelia Boynton Ramos. I mean, and when it came your time to have to stay there all night, you know, you just had to stay all night. And that spouse, you know, had to be on board because otherwise they would be jumping up and down and fussing. And we didn't have any of that, man.
That's
Everybody was committed to caring for Mrs. Amelia Boynton Robinson.
Well, you know, one of the things, Chief, that it makes me think about is that Rev said, you know, when the enemy had you tied up around and about, goodness and mercy show up, untie you and let you. It made me think about her work afforded her and inspired the people like yourselves and the other two caregivers you spoke of to be willing to make that level of a sacrifice for someone. But it was her work and her sacrifice prior to that. I mean, because if we're going to be open and honest, there's lots of people who could use care, right? Who could use 24-hour care. And most people are not going to be inspired and say, hey, I'll be the one. I'll make that sacrifice. So we have to believe, pay homage to, and give some credence to the sacrifice that she made when she put her life on the line for so many of us, that it created the content people like yourself to be inspired to say, if Miss Boynton calls, I'm going to respond. How about you talk a little bit, Chief, about what you learned in your few years of dealing with her? As I played the clip of her at the State of the Union address, and she was still mentally sharp. You know, and I can't imagine that you all didn't have some really in-depth conversations, that you even learned some new stuff about her and about the movement and stuff like that. Is there anything you'd like to share with the people about that?
Man, I tell you, it's so tremendous that I'd never be able to recall it in a few minutes. But I tell you one thing, I learned that love over hate was her main claim to fame. Mm-hmm. And everywhere she went, she was counseling people, charging people, challenging people, and preaching to people that you must love because hate will destroy you from inside. Mm-hmm. And even those little arrogant attitudes that I had about people, you know, that I may have not liked in the past,
mm-hmm.
when I got those doses of challenge from my mother, you know, it was about, hey, I'm above that. You be as crazy as you want to over there, or you be as ignorant as you want to over here, but I'm going to love you in spite of yourself. And that came through and from Queen Mother. That woman was so dedicated into being above that when Sheriff Jim Clark, the man who misused and abused her and locked her up in Selma, died, she had us take her to Sheriff Jim Clark's funeral. And I said, Queen Mother, why in the world do you want to go to this man's funeral? She said, because I want the world to know that I have no hatred, no malice. And she sat there among those white family members, and she talked about nothing but love, trust, and appreciation and what people of this world ought to be doing to keep their act straight and to do good by other people.
Man,
top of that, she was totally committed to children. And, you know, in her last days, say, her being sharp, you know, she was sharp right up until 5 months ago, you know, because in these last days, we had people around her who was overprotective, and we knew that her independence wouldn't tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't hurt their feelings, but she will signal to Harriet and Pamela and I that she wanted to do what she wanted to do. So we had a choice, man. We could have her lay up in that bed and watch that ceiling until her time was over. We had a choice of scheduling stuff around this country and getting her to it. Now, there was an inner war that people will never know about among those close to her about she wasn't able to go here. She's not able to go there. We didn't pay them no attention. We took her signal. And we took her to California. We took her to Florida. We took her to Dallas, Texas. We took her to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to New York, to Reverend Ike's old church. And, man, that woman performed like a natural-born champ. And that we were totally dedicated to making sure that every breath that she could breathe, that she could walk and talk, that she was reaching people, teaching people, and charging people with being a better people.
You know, in the clip that we showed, she talked about love, but she talked about loving yourself. And I thought it was extremely powerful when she said, you ask the average 5 or 6 year old, and I would even say you ask a whole bunch of people these days, even way older than that, who do you want to be like? And they would always name somebody other than themselves. I just thought that was one of the most profound things that I had heard in a long time, that they always want to be like somebody else. So, you know, teaching them and making them understand why they have to love themselves first and foremost, because how are you going to love somebody else if you don't love yourself? Right. You know, I just thought it was very key. It was very consistent with what you just said about her teaching and preaching love, and starting with yourself. And it was clear that love for yourself also gives you the courage and commitment to do some of the things that she did. And I can't imagine, you know, from my interactions with her over the years, I definitely know that, you know, she did not want to sit. She was not the type to want to sit someplace and just fade away. Right. She wanted to be out there and to stay involved and live her life to the fullest.
I tell you what drove me to schedule all of these things around this country, man. Mrs. Boynton Robinson told me that she, I tell God every morning, she didn't say nothing about action now. She said, I told God every morning to give me something to do in this 24-hour period.
Hmm.
And when she told me that, And I knew that she was going to wake up every morning depending on those of us around her who were still thinking active and capable to get her some work to do.
Mm.
So that's exactly what we did. And let me tell you what I did in Dallas that got me chewed out for 3 months, man, after we got back. We went to a church down there, and this guy, Thomas Hammond, had put this program together. And they had a whole bunch of children, man. And they had the praise dancers, and they had the singers of opera, and all of those children doing all of those things. And you know, when you get in these fast moving schedules, you get your stuff stacked up on top of each other. So we went into this church at 9 o'clock. Those children got wound up. Queen Mother was into the man big time.
Hmm.
And I eased up to her, and I said, we have to go now. She said, where are we going? I said, we have another appointment. So then I took her to a high-polluting church, man, one of these mega churches, you know, where everything was loud and people were shouting and dancing and going through changes. But both pastors were beautiful. And so Queen Mother didn't like that very much because she wanted to be right over there where we started at with those children. And so we got back on the plane, and coming back home, Queen Mother said, let me tell you something. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, now I don't ever want you to do what you did today again. I said, what did I do? She said, you took me away from where those children were over to that other church, and I wanted to be with those children. I said, yes, ma'am. And I thought that was going to resolve the situation until week after week after week after week, I was told one more time, don't you ever do that to me no more. Now, we got up in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the first setting we had was some 5 and 6 year olds, man, about 35 or 40 of them. And Queen Mother and I had a team thing we would do. You know, I'd give about the 8 to 10 highlights of her life. And then I'd pluck her into the certain areas where she had to sing the songs they sung in the jail.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to talk to God about when she almost drowned in the Savannah Harbor. But when she saw all those children, she said, I got this. I say, what do you mean? We not going to do what we plan to do? She looked at me real seriously and said, I got this. Well, I knew what that look meant because I had seen it from my grandmama before. You know, you better back off and get away from this. I got it. And so she did exactly what you talked about, man. She went straight to those children, and she charged them all with loving themselves. And she used as an analogy the flower beds, where they're all color flowers. They smell all kind of different ways. And they, you know, create the beauty of togetherness. And so she thought I was going to mess with her thing, but when she was telling her story, I went and got a little black boy and a little white boy and a little black girl and a little white girl, and I lined them up right beside her. So she looked at me with that sharp look, man, like, what you doing? I said, I'm getting you some flowers. Okay, well, that saved my life that day because she sensed that I was really in sync with her while she was doing her thing. Man, that woman was committed, sharp, determined, independent every step of the way, man, until about, 6 or 8 weeks ago when God gave her that last stroke, and she prepared to get on out of here.
Hmm. Well, Chief, listen, I really appreciate that you calling, man. I know for the listeners out there, I was sitting here going through my thing and trying to summons the words to try to express the gratitude that I have for her. As I looked at that picture and I saw you there, and I know that you had come and offered your service to us here in the community a long time ago. Well, not a long time ago, but a few years back. And it just all hit me at once. And I said, let me text Chief. I just texted him while I was sitting there listening to the video, and I asked him to respond. And the phone rang, and there he was right there on cue and responding in the way that you always do. So, dear brother, I want to thank you again for calling in. I only have a few more minutes here. I'm going to stay in touch with you. Maybe we can get back on here and do a large tribute to her and give it more time.
Very good. God did that telephone call you just made. Now, I want everybody listening to us to do this. Don't go out here talking no mess about what a great woman Queen Mother was. Use the research and the read it and whatever the television and videos to help to make yourself a better person and do a better job of helping to make this world a better place based on her legacy. Otherwise, shut up.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. So we will be in tune with you, and you take care, man. Appreciate it. Keep whistling.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye. All right, brothers and sisters, when the chief was here with us, boy, he whistled and whistled and whistled. Carol said, look, you can't whistle in the house. Stop whistling. All right, y'all. So it's about 5-6 minutes before the top of the hour. We've had a real interesting conversation with Mr. George Wissmiller of Watch. We are against the chemicals. And we also just had a very interesting conversation with Chief Frazier about his work with Queen Mother, Miss Amelia Boynton Robinson, who made her transition just a few days ago. And so it's been an honor to have this conversation with him. And hopefully you've enjoyed it. You've learned something, been inspired to love yourself and to be a better you so that this place can be a better place. I want to do a couple announcements just to remind you of some things that are coming up. Again, on Thursday, well, first of all, make sure you get on over to the farmer's market out there till noon. Go support the Urbana baseball, the middle school, the Urbana Tigers middle school team. They've got a game today against Normal. That's why I'll be headed when I leave here. We want you to get on out there to that farmer's market, though, reminding folks that you can use your link card or your SNAP benefits as well as your WIC coupons at the farmer's market if you have some. If you're someone who's receiving those benefits and that support, you can go and use it at the farmer's market and you can get double the value. So if you're going to use $20 off the SNAP card or link card, then you get $4 worth of produce and items out there that you could use. So keep that in mind as well. So on September 3rd, Speak Truth to the People. I just want to remind you that that's also coming up on September the 3rd. Thursday, September 3rd, 6:30 to 7:30. Speak Truth to the People in Douglas Park at the Under the Pavilion. We want to hate, mobilize and organize. We use this. Well, this is the Breakfast Club and the National Council of African-American Men. And on the flyer that we'll be circulating, you see the Adinkra symbol of democracy and unity. So we want to encourage you to come out. This weekly talk will discuss burning questions facing Black people locally, nationally or globally. Speak Truth to the People consists of a 15-minute talk, cultural presentations, and a group response. So we won't hold you long, 6:30 to 7:30, but we definitely want to see this grow and want to see this happen on a regular basis so we can continue to stay abreast of what's happening in the community. What's happening, though, like we said, locally, nationally, or globally, we've got to expand our understanding of what's happening around us. So that's on September 3rd in the park at Douglas Center, 6:30 to 7:30. Of course, we got Labor Day coming up Monday, September the 7th. We want to encourage folks to come out and support labor movement and the history of labor. It's going to be discussed a little bit there on the 7th, but you'll get a chance to be involved in the parade, see some of the labor unions that we have. Of course, we are under extreme attack from Governor Ronger. And we want to make sure that you all are come out and part of that. SEIU will be there. As the president, I will be there. We'll be marching along with the other various labor unions. That starts at 9:30 a.m. at Lincoln Square Mall. So come on out. All you SEIU listeners, I got a free T-shirt for you for anybody who walks with us. Paul, that's right. Got to wear that purple and gold, even for the retirees. Thursday, September 17th, we also have something coming up. This is an announcement from Carol's office, from State Representative Carol Ammons. We have another labor event. It is the labor history, celebrating the history of labor in Champaign County on Thursday, September 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Laborers International Union Hall, 108 East Anthony Drive in Urbana. So that's going to be, it's an event that's open to the public. We want you to come on out. Please join State Representative Carol Ammons for a fun and informative evening about the history of labor in Illinois and Champaign County. Stephanie Seale, Executive Director of Illinois Labor History Society, will be giving a presentation. Dinner will be provided and there will be activities for the children. Bring the whole family and celebrate labor in Champaign County with us. Again, this is sponsored by State Representative Carol Ammons. September 17th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the Labor's International Hall. And then on September 19th, I didn't see the actual, I think it's at the, this is the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers. Jenny Putman had given me a piece on this, and I don't have the flyer with me. Jenny, if you're listening, please call in and share that with us. It would be nice to hear that.
Is that the one that George was referring to?
Yes, okay. About the aquifer on the 19th, about the consent decree and stuff. On the 17th, it's on the 19th. I'm sorry,
CCHCC, Google it. I'm pretty sure you'll get it.
So. Yes, indeed. So my time is almost up. I've got 1 minute, and I again want you guys to consider grabbing the book Bridges Across Jordan by Miss Amelia Boynton as we use her legacy and her sacrifice to be better people ourselves. All right. I think I have... I've exhausted what I'm going to bring. So as John Lee Johnson would say when he was the host of Higher Ground, stay out of trouble. And as Paul Mew likes to say, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you. So now, Paul.
I wanted to highlight Jim Kilgore's got the book tour going on, and he was on the radio in the L.A. market on a show called Uprising Radio.
Oh, okay.
It's available through Pacifica, but the host Sonali Kalatar wants us to run the whole thing, so.
I'm gonna have to bring them.
You can find that.
Bring General on the show with me, so we can have some conversation. Indeed. Him and Brian. Yes, indeed.
It's restorative and transformative justice is what I pulled out of the last few minutes of that interview that Jim Kilgore was talking about. So I don't know the title of the book, but you want to pass me that circuit?